Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, griefsters, I hope you're having an okay week. We had some pretty good news of the weekend. That's definitely made me feel very, very happy this week. But wherever you are, I hope that the week has been not too hard on you. Thank you so much for your amazing comments on Adam Buxton's episode last week. I know a lot of you said it was a really weird feeling to see his name come up because it was like, oh, yay, like, I love Adam Buxton. Oh no, he's on the Griefcast, which I completely relate to. That strange, bittersweet feeling of someone returning. But thank you for your lovely comments, and I pass them on to Adam as well, because I know he isn't on social media, but I did let him know how lovely you've all been about his episode. If you did enjoy the episode and you've been enjoying the show, please do, as ever, rate and review and subscribe. It helps other people find the show. This week I was talking to someone else who basically needs no introduction. It is the incredible and amazing and wonderful writer, broadcaster and gardener, Monty Dom. Monty came on to talk to me about his dog, who recently passed away, but we also talked about all the griefs that Monty had experienced along the way.
The thing I miss most on a social level, funnily enough, are not my sort of tiny handful of friends, because I live out in the sticks, and one of the sort of prices of living in the countryside as opposed to town is that everybody you know lives as far away as it's possible to be. Mm. So just geography means you see people very seldom. And, you know, I have close friends in Scotland and close friends in Kent and close friends there who I might not see for 2 years. Mm. But I do get to see the crew every week, and some of them I've worked with for 20 years.
Wow.
So we are friends, and we share experiences, even though it's always work-based. And if you travel with people, as I do a lot, you share every meal together. You share all your work together. It's a completely intense experience.
God, yeah, it's fascinating talking to you about anything, but obviously we are here to talk about something slightly more sad. So who are we remembering today?
Well, in the middle of lockdown, my dog, Nigel, died, and he died very suddenly. It was a beautiful May day, and I had just finished the book, My Garden World, which came out a few weeks ago, literally that day. And I've been working on it very intensively. I mean, really all day, every day for months. And he had been with me all the time, as he had been for the last 12 years. And it was a lovely day, and he'd been outside, and at 7 o'clock in the evening we went for a walk. He was fine, and I put him to bed at 10 o'clock, and then at 1 in the morning my son, because my son and daughter-in-law had been in lockdown with us, woke me and said, Nigel is having fits. You need to do it. And so I stayed with him for the rest of the night, and he fitted all night. And that's a really I don't know if you've ever been with a person when they've had a seizure.
No, not a seizure.
Well, I have, and it's really shocking. It's really dramatic. it's such a violent thing, you know, and you feel as a somebody who's trying to help, I mean, I sort of know what to do, but it feels inadequate because they are, it's so violent and people can break bones and this. Anyway, you had a large dog doing just that all night.
Oh,
again
God.
And again and again.
And he'd never had seizures before?
Never before. And
oh, God.
So by morning I was thinking, please just die. Just die. Mm. Because this is not good. You know, this is... and because of lockdown, and at that point it was still absolute. I mean, there didn't seem to be, you know, there were people with coronavirus were being told not to go to hospital, let alone dogs.
Yeah.
Anyway, I rang the vet at 6 a.m, who was brilliant, and said, well, bring him in. And you said, you do realise, obviously, you're going to have to be in the car park there's going to be no contact. So we did all that, took him in. He was fitting in the car. He was fitting in the car park. And then I had to film that day. So I filmed Gardener's World with this going on. And we did it. And all day, you know, there'd be phone calls coming in saying, we've tried this drug, it's not working. We've tried this drug, it's not working. And finally... the drug they used was the drug that they used to put dogs down, but in a small dose. And they said, to be honest, we should just up the dose. Just up the dose and that will end it. And he'd had a brain tumour. And it had just, obviously, at that moment, just that critical moment, the tumour had grown. And I only knew this with hindsight. Anyway, that was that. And so that was shocking. I mean, that's the right word. It was just a very visceral, shocking experience.
What breed was Nigel?
He's a golden retriever. And the extraordinary thing about Nigel was that he was our family. I mean, he was one of... We have five dogs, and he was one of them, and he was one of the family. And anybody who owns a pet of any kind, where it's one of the family that's been with you for 12 and a half years, it's a loved member of the family. And that's a private grief. And it's as great... I mean, I've had lots of dogs, and I've had to put them down. I've had dogs... I had a dog that came down in the morning, it was dead on the floor. I've had dogs that had traffic accidents. So, I mean, I've had to deal with this. And one of the things that I think that as a responsible pet owner, you have to take on board is when you get a pet, one of you is going to die first. And it's probably not going to be you.
Hopefully.
So the point thing is, one, you are going to have to deal with this.
Yeah, you're going to have to face that death. Yeah. And I think that's so important that you are honour that. Because like you said, they are a member of the family. And we've had people come on to talk about a dog and a cat before. And I think it can be hard, I think, if you haven't experienced pets in your life and you haven't, you know, had them even for a year. Like, just like you said, to understand that they are absolutely a part of the family. Also, I think with dogs, I don't know if you feel about this, like some dogs are different. Was Nigel one of those?
Nigel was different. I mean, the extraordinary thing about Nigel was that he was, and I'm really not exaggerating, he was world famous. He was, at Christmas, he used to get more Christmas cards than we did. Every week, we always got about half a dozen letters addressed to Nigel Longmeadow, Herefordshire. Now, Longmeadow is a made-up name. It's not the name of my house. It's a standard BBC ploy. So it's just Nigel, who? Just Nigel, made-up name, county. And they.
Wow.
And what I never knew was, were there every week 500 letters that didn't get delivered to us because people said, what? I don't know. Who's this? Nigel
in Hertfordshire.
Exactly.
Like, why am I getting these cards?
Exactly.
It's so weird.
Or is it just the genius of the post office, you know, that delivers the mail? He was genuinely loved. On his birthday, there would be just piles of presents would come through for him. Whenever I gave talks, I used to do a lot of sort of one-man shows. And I knew people just wanted Nigel. Really, if I came on with Nigel, they would have all cheered. So I used to show a picture and say, OK, I'll go now. I'll just leave that up. You know, bathe in it, bask in it. And then when you've had enough, I'll come back. I remember crossing the street in Tokyo, someone running saying, where's Nigel? Why haven't you got Nigel with you? Or getting onto a plane. I got onto a plane in a small town. We were filming this garden in this little small town in Kansas. And I really genuinely can't remember the name of it. And the guy said, hi, guy, you know, where's your dog? Where's your dog? I had to go to Buckingham Palace for something, and the policeman with his gun said, what? No, Nigel. You know, it was it became a refrain. Always you get on a plane.
Yeah.
So that he was co-owned. He was ours, he was private, and he was very public. So what I did was I didn't tell anyone for a week. So we could grieve and own that grief. And we buried him. And then we had this curious thing whereby I was filming for 2 days. So on the evening of the first day that we, you know, had the conversation with Bert, and I said, really, okay, fine. Just, and he said, do you want to come and see him? And I said, actually, I don't, because, you know, I've held in my arms all night. I don't want to see him on a slab in your surgery through a window. But I said, I can't bury him tonight or tomorrow because I'm filming. So they put him in the freezer. The whole thing was both incredibly gut-wrenchingly sad, but at the same time hysterically funny.
Yes, and so we were,
and I said, please make him look nice, you know, just so. And then he said, well, we're going to have to fit him in. So I had to go and fit him in the freezer.
Because Golden Retrievers are quite big, and Nigel was quite, a big dog.
He was a big dog. He was a great
big hairy. Why didn't they have a chest freezer ready for this sort of situation?
Anyway, we buried him 2 days later. And, of course, he was frozen solid. So we dug this big hole in the garden. I mean, we have a pet cemetery. He's the fifth dog we've buried in this area in the garden. And we dug a big hole and we lined it with flowers that I picked from the garden, and we put 50 tennis balls, because he was mad about tennis balls, and we got a bowl and we put his favourite food and we put lots of biscuits.
Sweet.
And then we put frozen Nigel in there, who was, as my son said, like a hairy lolly. He was, and in fact, he looked really peaceful. He was this great big bear asleep, and because he'd been frozen, he was frozen in the moment of a calm death. So actually he looked he really did look, and his fur was still flowing and fur, but you then touched the body and it was a block. It was just a stone block. So that was both freaky and genuinely funny. I mean, in other words, we were hysterical. We were laughing and crying and you know, all that.
That seems so fitting for a dog's funeral. Like, because dogs are so brilliant and also the silliest things you've ever seen. Like, and if you have had dogs, you can have a clever dog who will do something that you cannot believe it's that stupid. Like, it's just, they do sometimes just, you know, they don't have that, the way that cats often, you're like, I don't have to worry about you. Often with a dog, you're like, oh, what are you doing? And so I think that's quite fitting that he had this sort of slightly comedy funeral.
He had a comedy
with
funeral.
All his tennis balls his biscuits.
And we buried him. And then we got a huge block of stone. In fact, we had to go and get the huge block of stone. I knew where it was. So we took a... But I think that was the first time I'd left the garden since his lockdown. So we went with my son's pickup truck and we got this block of stone and we managed to get it on him. And it's buried. And anyway, we had that. And that was... And then you process it. And the thing is, on one level, he was 12, he had a good life, he had other than the sort of 8 hours or whatever it was at that night, it was a good death because it was, the last day was lovely and happy, and once he was at the vets, there was no pain, and in fact the vet said he wouldn't have had any, when you have seizures, you're not in pain, you don't know what's going on, you have no idea. So there was that was the good thing. And then I released it. I mean, you release a death. What does that mean? You know,
statement.
Well, yeah, I did. Yeah. I put out a press statement through Reuters in a very old-fashioned way. Wow. And I put it onto social media. And it was the front page news on the Times. It was in all the... my son had to take the car in to be fixed. And the guy said, oh, sorry to hear about your dog. And Tom said, how did you hear that? He said, oh, on the telly, you know. And I had someone ring me up from Tonga, saying, I've just heard the news. God. You know, well, is this awful? And then, of course, because it had all happened a week earlier, we'd gone quite a long way to process it. So we weren't, you know, we'd been through the various stages of grief, and which is shock, sadness, sort of the slight disbelief, this thing of seeing the person, you know, all these things that one knows about. And I've experienced with people. But also, actually, by then we were saying, we got to the stage, just as the rest of the world was shocked, of thinking, weren't we lucky? Wasn't it good? You know, isn't it great that we had those 12 years and that he was such an extraordinary character and he was so well known? It'll never happen again. I mean, we knew that there was a one-off. You know, it was... So I suppose the whole point of this story is it was such an unusual experience of grief. It was such a sort of... You could imagine if it was a famous person. That's what it must be like for the family when a very famous comedian or actor, say, dies, who the world loves but doesn't really know.
Yeah, and we've talked... I interviewed Rosa Hoskins, whose dad was Bob Hoskins, and other people with famous parents who said this disconnect of what you're feeling and then hearing them, you know, in films from the 70s, suddenly on your television, or you're just trying to make a cup of tea and their voice comes on the radio. And it's like, it's a very, like you said, disconnected from where your grief is. And I think that's really, it's really interesting that you chose to wait, because I think it's so helpful to give yourself time and space to process how you felt about it as a family. And as you said, to reach that nice point with a pet of like, well, they were really brilliant. We were really lucky. Like, that's really nice. And that doesn't mean the sadness doesn't disappear. You know, you still will look and think, oh, they were so great. But to then have everybody else's emotion and you be like, oh, no, we've done the burial. we've we're in a different place. I think it's very sensible and caring for your own grief to put that distance towards it.
It was, I mean, what was interesting was it was absolutely a family decision that we all felt that... And the expression we used, and you know, we're quite a unsentimental family. You know, we're farmers. We animals die on us all the time. We keep sheep, and sheep die. I mean, they always say that, you know, sheep get born and then find interesting ways to die. it's so that we're not overtly sentimental about it, which is not the same as saying we don't love our pets. We do.
No,
absolutely. But we all felt that it belonged to us and we didn't want to share it until we were ready. And that was exactly how we all felt as a family.
Yeah.
It was when we were ready, we would share it, because we knew that once we shared it, it would be taken from us to a certain extent. Mm. You can't possess every aspect of it and let other people have it. Sharing means letting go to some degree. And it did work out like that. I mean, I'm still getting letters now. I got one last week, at the end of September, commiserating with my grief and hoping that I was getting over it. And I was trying to think, what grief? What's happened? You know, I mean, in other words, I've really moved on from that now. And yet, obviously, someone else, it's not, what they were saying was they hadn't moved on. They wanted to share what they felt. And that's fine. That's absolutely fine.
Do you think
fine.
As well, I wonder, like, the timing... Because I think obviously people would have been sad because I remember watching him. He was a lovely, lovely dog. But also because we're in this strange place of, you know, confusion and uncertainty. So I know that there has been this, you know, this huge, like, I've watched Gardener's World all my life, right? And I have had friends who have had no interest in anything like that text me and be like, oh, I'm watching Gardener's World. I've been like, oh, okay, all right. And they've said, oh, no, it's just so nice, you know, because what was happening, I've decided to look at my garden. I've decided to have these thoughts. And I wonder if, like, something like Nigel, who was like a sort of continuing presence of yours, that for him to go in these uncertain times, it allows people to release that sadness of like, oh, where are we? What's happening?
I think that's exactly right. And I think also for Nigel, because we often, as a family, would say, we love Nigel, but he's really thick.
Some dogs are just wonderful but stupid. Yeah.
And that what you see is absolutely what you get. You know, Nigel's hidden depths make a very thin veneer. And so, which was part of his charm, of course.
Yeah, yeah. A stupid dog is very charming.
Yeah, but what's interesting is if ever I suggested that in public, people didn't like it. Because it was too much information. They had built an idea of Nigel, and that didn't fit it. They could take that he was goofy or he was slightly, but actually to say he was thick was the wrong word, even though it was absolutely the
not
right
my
word.
Nigel. Nigel.
Exactly,
no.
Exactly.
He wouldn't be.
So people had constructed Nigel. He became to represent constancy. Mm. Loyalty, simplicity, honesty, decency, all these words that actually seem to be so lacking from public life, at least.
Yeah, yeah.
And so challenged, you know, at every call, every turn. You just think, oh, how could that happen?
Yeah.
And I think also the thing about the pandemic is that there is no one alive who's had to live through it. My parents lived through the war, which is probably the best analogy, although I think actually this is very, very small fry compared to that. But and I think it's sort of an unhelpful analogy. But
it's the closest we've got, really.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
And I think that, which is why I think the very few surviving people from the war are so important and become so fated, because they're the people who got through it and the survivors. And I think that take away one of those underpinning visible icons of decency, and it's one fewer left. You know, this phrase that when somebody who is really special dies, there seems to me there are two things you feel. One is a kind of existential loneliness. You feel someone you needed to be there is no longer there. I remember when my father died, I remember thinking, I've now got to be a man because there's no one else to do it. I don't want to do it. I don't even know what I mean by saying that, but I know I've got to. And I think that, or if one of someone really good, you know is good, dies, you just feel some goodness has gone and it's not replaced.
Yeah, it's a very pure sadness, isn't it? Of like you said, I guess as you are a farmer, you know things die. You know, we do know that in our brains, people die, that's what happens. But when something good goes, there is this real, a pure sadness of, oh, the world will be a bit
and
sadder
also,
now.
As you said, you know, with the virus, people, real people, were dying. And I mean, one of the things that I feel very strongly, again, as a pet lover and a farmer, is actually people are more important than animals. That, you know, it matters more when a human you love dies than when an animal you love does. And I think you have to be clear about that. It's of course, doesn't mean so you don't love animals as much, and they aren't desperately important. To some people, their only companion. And I do know that some people really genuinely are bereft when a cat or a dog dies. And it's a real proper grief and should be taken seriously. But when a spouse or a parent or a child dies, that's something else. It really is.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd. We talk a lot on the show about the hierarchy of grief and how it doesn't exist, you know, because we try to level out, like, grief is grief. And it's not always helpful to be like, oh, well, your grief is this or your grief is that. And I think I agree with you. I think sort of philosophically, people matter more, and you need, you know, in terms of how you run a society or how you're thinking about things. But I think for some people, what I've learned from doing this show is they perhaps don't have those people. And so that pet becomes as important, or that other people have not fulfilled what they need in a family situation. And so that pet becomes absolutely family.
I agree. And I would stress that I'm not in any way disagreeing with that or decrying that. But what I'm saying is that the grief might be as deep and as real. that there is a real genuine bereavement to be had from losing a much-loved companion, which whether that companion is, you know, it could be a cat, it could be a dog, it could be a horse, it could be, I mean, God's sake, any animal, any domestic animal. And particularly if you're alone, or particularly if you're lonely. Mm. You may not be alone, but you might be lonely, you know. But I think that we live in a world that is more and more divorced from death of all kinds, and certainly death of animals. We don't, you know, the people who will eat meat as long as it doesn't look like meat.
Interesting. I see what you mean, that we forget that it happens.
Yeah.
And I would also argue we do that to humans, because we, you know, the whole process of death is hospitalization, and often we don't see the body, and things are very neat and medicalized. And I think this, like what you're saying, is the same with animals, that we get into, like, we don't want the other side of it. We want to have this nice bit without the, pets will die. And when you buy one, or when you get one, it is your responsibility to give them a good death, as much as it is, you know, for people you love.
Yeah.
And we talk about that so much on the show, of how to have a good death. Like, you talk about it beforehand, tell people what you want for your funeral plans, tell people what your passwords are, so that when when you are in this a situation where you need to be held, people can honour you in that way. They can make the decisions for you. But it's, you know, I think we find all of these decisions, animals or human, really difficult to have.
Yes, and the less we have to do it, the harder it is. I mean, one of the things about farming, particularly sheep, and we have far fewer sheep now, but at one point we had nearly 3,000 sheep.
Wow.
So that at that stage, at any one time, almost every day of the year, there is one that either has died on you or you have to kill.
Oh my God!
So
I'm not from a farming background. Yeah,
so the point being is death is in a curious way absolutely ever present.
Mm.
And you know, when you are lambing, there are always, you come across lambs with their eyes pecked out and that sort of thing, which is the most brutal sort of, and that's, yet it's completely natural. It's completely natural. So on one level, you get hardened to it. On one level, that you accept the physical side. You know what goes on. You know what you have to do. And that's why I think it's easier for someone like me to differentiate between animal death and human death. Because obviously, I do not want to kill a person. But if I saw an animal suffering, I wouldn't hesitate to kill it.
Yeah,
I wouldn't like it. I don't want to do it, but I would do it, because it would be the right thing to do. Whereas if it was a person, I wouldn't do that.
Relief to hear, Monty. Yeah. You're not going to go out and kill people. Don't walk past him if you've got cold. Monty's ready with a hammer.
So the point is there is that real difference. Whereas I think actually in modern life, a lot of people would find that at best difficult, and at worst, wow, you know, what are you saying? That is too much. That's a step too far.
Yeah, and do you think, I mean, I suppose it's obvious a question in a way, but do you think it is because we are so divorced from where our food comes from and farming is? Yeah. And, you know, I'm someone who grew up in the city, is from the city.
Yeah.
And, I married a country person.
Right.
And certain things have really shocked me. I'm like, we're going to what? Like that, and it's like, and I think, if you haven't grown up around it, it can be really shocking. And it's sad in a way, because you're, like you said, it's like we want nature, but without any of the truth, which I think is also how I feel about humans and death. Like, we want humans, we want connection, we want intimacy, but we don't want to deal with this like bit at the end where they die, even though that's guaranteed to happen.
When I was 16, I was brought up in my grandmother's house. My mother was an only child, and my father, being in the army, was all over the world. I was born abroad in an army base. And then when I was one, we came back to England, and my grandfather had died. And my grandmother wasn't very well, so she lived in a big house. So there were five children by now, so we all went and lived with her in her house, which my mother was sort of passed on to my mother. So I grew up with Granny, and she died when I was 16. Mm. And she died at 2 in the morning. And I remember my mother coming to wake me up and saying, "Granny's died. Do you want to come and see her?" And I said, "No." She said, "Well, I really think you ought to."
Mm.
So I went in and saw Granny, dreading, I mean, really scared.
Of course.
Properly scared at 16. Yeah. Just, I mean, obviously, I'd never seen a dead body. I was frightened of what I might see. And in fact, I'm so glad I did. Because A, it wasn't frightening. Mm. And B, Granny wasn't there.
Yeah.
She really wasn't. her body was, but she wasn't. That was, I mean, there was nothing more elaborate. That was just really apparent. Mm. So that her death then became something I understood. It wasn't an, you know, it was, she had gone.
Mm. I know, it's amazing because everything I've read on death and grief is see the body, see the body.
Yeah.
Because something in a human's brain needs to see a dead body for somewhere in you to go, it's dead. Even if someone tells you that, you know, that's why we have this obsession of putting the body to rest, getting our bodies back. It matters to us, even though you said they're not there. And I think if you have someone in your life like your mum did who can guide you through that process, you're so lucky.
Yeah.
And when my dad died, we were with him. And it's only because my mum was like, of course, we're staying with him. We're going to watch this happen.
Yeah.
And I had exactly the same experience of seeing someone and being like, oh, he's not there. I see. We inhabit this body, but once you're gone, you're just not in that place anymore. And I think you really need an older generation or somebody to be like, don't be afraid. This is important. Is it, otherwise, you can miss out.
I remember when I was a child, my father, for some reason, we were talking about death. And I said to my father, do you want to be cremated or buried? He said, I don't care. I won't need my body anymore. Mm. You do what you like with it. I remember both being shocked by the sort of flippancy of the remark, but also profoundly sort of aware that, you won't need your body anymore. Mm. It's simply not, you're not there anymore.
You're really not.
Yeah.
Did you see his body after he
No, I didn't see my father's body. In fact, I had a very weird experience with my father. My father had leukemia, and he died 37 years ago. So a long time ago. I was 26, 27.
Oh, still young.
Yeah. And he was dying. I knew he was dying. Mm. And I went and saw him. I was working in London, and Sarah and I had this business. We were working like mad. And I went to see him, sort of knowing it was the last time I was going to see him. But he had been very ill for months. And he was in bed, and I talked to him. But I didn't really say goodbye to him at all. Mm. I mean, he was very old school. I'm 65. He was 40 when I was born. He was born in 1915. His parents were incredibly old school.
Okay.
So his father was born in 1870. So that it was, we had a very formal relationship.
Mm.
And so I sort of said goodbye, but only in a way, well, bye, cheerio, and that was it. Mm. So, but at the same time, knowing I was probably never going to see him again. Anyway, a week later, I got a phone call from my brother-in-law saying, your father's just died. Oh. And he said, there's nothing much more I can say, but, you know, talk. And he was, my brother-in-law, who was actually a priest, so often had to deal with people who had died. I talked to him about it later. He said, sometimes you just have to tell people things and just let them process it. You know, we'll talk about this later, sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I put the phone down. 5 minutes later, I was on my own in the house, and I was upset, but thinking, I was slowly getting used to the idea. Really, it wasn't a terrible shock. It was, but it was a big thing, a big big thing. And then the phone went, and it was my mother, and I said hello, not sort of wondering what she was going to say. I said hello, and there was sort of this tone of voice, quite chirpy. I said, are you all right? I said, yes, I've just come back from seeing Daddy, and he's fine. And immediately I thought, there's something very odd going on here. Anyway, what had happened was she'd been to hospital, which was 40 minutes away from home, seen him, and she said he talked to him, and he said he was feeling a bit cold, but I covered him over. And anyway, she described how that she talked to him and that she pulled the blanket up around him. And he was clearly going downhill, but he seemed to be okay, and they made plans for what they would do tomorrow. Oh. And I was listening at the other end of the phone.
Oh, Monty.
Thinking, what do I do? What do I say? Because she's on her own at home.
Oh, God, that's so hard.
And I didn't have the courage to tell her. And I was sort of processing it myself. So I talked to her for about half an hour, trying to find the right moment.
Oh, God.
To say something. Mm. And in the end, I didn't. And she was saying, well, fine, and I'm going to go and see him tomorrow and I'll let you know how he is. So they put the phone down. And so I immediately rang. And I didn't, I thought I must ring a neighbour so she could go around. But I didn't know then, I didn't have the number of her neighbour. Yeah. So I rang my sister, who did have a number. And a neighbour went round, and then my sister rang my mother. So that was a very, very distressing experience. I mean, that was really disturbing.
That's so hard. I mean, it's like, it's almost not, it's not a job a child ever wants to have to do. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, that's when that dynamic is really like, I don't, I'm the child. I don't have to give this information. But yeah. I think what you did was really beautiful because, oh, I just really, I really, really, really feel for you. That is such a difficult, especially when someone's in the process of optimism.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't like she said, oh, you know, I'm a bit worried. And you could kind of go, okay, yeah, listen, they just rang me. You're listening to hope. And how can you just punch a hope? Like, you can't. And but what you did is so amazing that you went, made sure a neighbour was there. Then when the sister rang, she had, you know, she got the best way of getting that information. Because what good had it done? I know you say courage, but I think it was courageous what you did to let her have hope for a few more minutes.
I mean, the point was, this is not just a new experience. It's like someone sort of waking up in the Antarctic. Mm. I'm in such strange territory here. Mm. I'm in such uncharted waters.
Yeah.
And I do not know what to do.
Mm.
So therefore, whatever I do is going to be made up as I go along. It's going to be completely... I've had nothing that remotely matches this experience. And as I say, I mean, one of the odd things... I mean, it was interesting that it upset me talking to you about it, because I've hardly ever talked about this. I mean, there aren't many people who I would talk about it to. To me, it's an incredibly poignant thing, her by his bedside.
Yeah.
Me hearing it, knowing he was dead, this person she was talking about was dead, even though she was alive to her. And it was, I imagine, it must be what it's like talking to someone who's got Alzheimer's, talking about a dead husband or spouse or whatever it might be. I imagine that it's that same thing. Because to her, he was as alive as he has ever been. He was 100% alive. And to me, he was 100% dead. And I knew he was dead.
God, that is such a, and then, of course, is such a strange situation.
Just thinking about it, actually, for about 10 minutes, I remember thinking, well, maybe my brother-in-law's got it wrong.
Of course.
So you don't know, you know.
Because, of course, it's hope on the table. And if someone is filled with that, of course, as a son, you can't help but be like, oh, yeah, maybe her world is true. Because you want it to be true. You want it to be true. And I think this is the thing, you know, we don't particularly talk about death. We don't know how to, you know, handle things. And, you know, I was very young when I first encountered it. So I've been talking about it for a long time. But then I have since experienced not being so close to the epicenter of death and having to tell people or having to have those conversations and someone who's been doing this since she was 15 and I've struggled to find the words and I think you know, like, we just don't have these conversations and so we're not practiced. But also I think that situation was extremely, like you said, like waking up in Antarctica. I think that's a really good metaphor because it's just such a sort of horrible trick of timing that she had taken that long. They must have tried to ring her. They got through to you.
I mean, it was just a freak sort of bad luck. But it was an interesting experience. The other experience I had with my father was a very odd one, which actually I was going to include in this book, but I didn't because it felt inappropriate, is that I was processing his death, and I'd had a complicated relationship with him. I mean, he was very formal, he was very military. I was the youngest son. I was in many ways a disappointment because I sort of didn't do what he wanted. But in other ways, you know, we were quite close. I mean, it was a very complicated relationship. And I was walking along Regent's Canal to work. I lived in Hackney, and I worked in Islington, and I used to walk along there every morning.
Yeah.
And a kestrel flew across from Holborn, up in the sky, straight line. And I'm very interested in birds, and I immediately spotted it was a kestrel, which is an unusual thing to see over the middle of London. And it flew straight towards me, up in a direct line, and with a completely overwhelming certainty, I knew it was my father. And it stopped and stopped over my head and turned and left.
Oh, Monty.
And flew away. And I have never known such grief as in that moment.
Wow.
And clearly, you know, I understand it. I understand everything. Mm. Of course it was, it wasn't my father. Of course it was a symbol. Of course it was a metaphor. Of course it was, a way of managing grief. But I can't even think about it without feeling grief, let alone talk about it. And I remember feeling utter despair and loss. But maybe that's just what you have to go through. Maybe that's just what grief is.
It is. And again, I think it comes back to what we were talking about of allowing, taking away the sort of negative connotations of that, of being like, oh, it's despair, it's a bad thing, of like, that's grief. It's utter despair. And it's looking at something and feeling your heart is being ripped out in front of you and you're watching it go. And, you know, you're like, how will I ever walk or breathe again? And then suddenly you are. And these moments that we don't allow ourselves as humans to have, to go, parents, like the loss of a parent it's just massive. It's just absolutely huge. And when, like you said, I also think this idea of, oh, it's a metaphor is really interesting because, like you say, it sort of doesn't matter, does it? Whether it is a metaphor or not, or what, the feelings are what matter.
Yes.
You
created that. It wasn't didn't come from an outside agency. It came from within you. It's like a dream. You know, you make your dreams. They're not visitations from another world. And I think that, I mean, I've often thought about that image and thought about how it's sort of how you can focus grief onto things. I mean, I know I suffer from depression and I say, touch wood, actually, it's been fine over the last 2 or 3 years. But one of the features I know when things are getting bad, I will find intense anguish is probably the right word, but it's sadness at maybe just two notes of music or just the sight of someone's face or even when I have known seeing a leaf blur across a piece of road has reduced me to tears. And it's because you are, what's inside you is putting it out onto these external things. And obviously that is then feeding a trigger back in. And in a way it works in the same way, that if the grief is something that has to find some kind of outlet, it has to be measured in some way.
Definitely.
It's not an inchoate, formless thing that
we talk about on the show, that it will wait. It will wait until you see that kestrel, that leaf, that snowfall. And I think nature often is the thing that, it's so tricksy, isn't it? Because I think our lives are very busy and you can keep yourself, I'm not grieving, I'm fine, I'm fine. And then when you do look at nature and you allow that into your heart, there's something about it that makes you go, that's how I'm feeling, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm feeling very sad and very lonely.
And I think that thing of waiting, I mean, you know, there are, when the trigger is pulled, that's it. And it can be 10 years.
Oh yeah, it will wait. That's the lesson I've learned. It will just sit there. Like, I just thought, I can outrun you. I'm really young and fast. And then I got to my 30s, was like, oh, I see. It's just because that's the thing. It's not, I think when I was younger, I was like, oh, it's, you know, it needs to be fooled, I need to trick it. And then you realize it's actually quite a benevolent force that just wants you to feel its pain.
But there is no question about it that feeling pain is part of the equation of feeling joy. You cannot have one without the other. You cannot.
Sadly.
And actually it is better to feel both than to feel neither.
Yes, absolutely. And on that beautiful note, it was so wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much, Monty. I really appreciate it.
That's a pleasure.
Talking to me about Nigel and everyone else as well.
Pleasure to talk to you.
You can follow Monty on Twitter and Instagram at The Monty Don, and his new book, My Garden World, is out now, available from all good bookshops. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was edited by Kate Holland. The music was provided by The Glue Ensemble. The artwork is by Jade Perkin, and I have been Carrie Lloyd. Thank you for listening. And remember, you are not alone.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row, dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.